Welcome to episode 36 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. On this episode, we're excited to welcome the author of What We Pick Up, Stacy Brewster of Launch Creative Northwest. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
Well, first of all, hello. Thank you for being on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate it. We probably should let folks know that you're also our neighbor, but it's just wonderful that Andy and I won the neighbor lottery and we have you and John as neighbors.
Oh, thank you. We feel the same way, both about you both, but yeah, when we moved in 11 years ago, just the whole neighborhood, this little pocket of Southeast, it's just been amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really happy with our neighborhood. Or neighborhood.
Yes, as the case may be, just, you know, house by house.
Yeah, we're gonna flip this neighborhood into a neighborhood, one house by house.
Love it.
So I am going to start off with your childhood. So, you know, I want to know more about you. I have the luxury of meeting your parents when they came and visited. They were super nice. I want to know, like, how did you become the adult, Stacy?
Oh my gosh. A lot of trial and error, Michael. I grew up in Los Angeles. I mean, sort of origin story, childhood. I grew up in LA. We moved to the San Francisco Bay Area when I was like 12 because my dad got a job up there. And then my parents split when I was 15. And, you know, both were still living in the Bay Area. I ended up going to NYU film school. So kind of moved cross country to go to film school and then moved back to LA when I graduated. I started working in television for a few years and then met my partner, now husband, there in LA. We were both working in television at the time. He was a publicist and I was on the production and doing, you know, kind of associate producer level stuff by the time we met. And then he got a job offer in New York, and I'd always sort of wanted to scratch that itch of what it would be like to now go back to New York and live there under my own steam. John had never lived there either. So we packed up. His job was at NBC in New York. And I parlayed that into a job in advertising, just given my background in production, fell into advertising. A friend had worked at a firm out there. And I was kind of already, my inkling was, maybe production wasn't the best fit for me. I was really skilled at it, but I really wanted to be more on the creative side. And I was starting to think that I wanted to write fiction, not be sort of stuck in this mold of screenwriting necessarily. So that was sort of the seed was planted. And in New York, we lasted maybe 2 years before we both realized we didn't want to work in production at all. And wanted to completely switch things up. And my husband wanted to become a therapist. So we were targeting schools that were for social work. And my sister one of my sisters in California had just moved to Beaverton, actually. And so it was a little bit on a radar. I also had a good friend who had shot a documentary out here. I'd been up to Oregon a little bit as a kid, but never as far north as Portland. So I had really never been until we came out for Thanksgiving week in, was that 2006? And in 3 months we were moving into an apartment here. I mean, we just, before getting into school, before having any jobs lined up, we just like, we knew we wanted to leave New York and this was the best fit. So we ended up here. I continued to write little very earnest short stories. I wanted to write a novel and I had sort of started drafting that, but I figured that I had to get something published. And the only way to do that would be to start small and write short stories. Of course, I didn't realize how hard short stories were. to write at the time. I may have gone back and done things a little bit differently, but I really stuck with it for a really long time until started publishing work. And, you know, meanwhile, my husband went to grad school, graduated, became a therapist, got his own private practice. And I'd stayed working full time, not in production, doing all sorts of things here while I worked on my craft, just sort of getting better bit by bit. Fast forward, you know, almost 15 years now, being in Portland, and I have my first book coming out. So
you're like the Adele of short story writing. We just wait anxiously, and we have the most amazing thing.
Thank you. Yes, I am definitely the Adele of short story writing. Michael, I'm putting that on my quote board because
you should.
I appreciate that.
Just came to me, but it seems right. So
hopefully it's worth the wait.
Yeah, absolutely. So I read your book. It's amazing. And I really like various short stories coming together and being, I don't know. That's not an anthology, is it? No.
No. I mean, cause they're all mine, but there's something about the pieces in a collection when they are in conversation with each other. I think when I first had the idea, you know, I should say up front, like I've also published poetry. I've written a lot of, I've done a lot of screenwriting in the last few years and got a fellowship, Oregon Literary Fellowship for drama a couple years ago with a script I wrote. So I like switching up genres all the time, but before I moved to screenwriting, I kind of put in one file all the stories I had either published or were trying to get published to see if they'd be in conversation with each other, to see if I had a collection. And I had to let that sit in a drawer for a while because I wasn't really sure that they were. And then an editor friend came into my life. I'd really put out sort of call to the universe to have a editor that was going to sort of get me and see me. And my friend Jerry Sampson, who edits for Buckman Journal here in Portland, a local indie press, mostly known for its journal. It's won some national awards. And they recruited me to have a story in their collection and published one of my stories a couple of years ago. And I just became fast friends with Jerry, their editor there, because she's a screenwriter as well as a fiction writer. We were just kind of both wearing these dual hats here in Portland, and that was a good connection. And we, about 6 months into the pandemic and feeling like I was not inspired to write at all, took out that manuscript again and, you know, kind of changed some things around and asked Jerry to read it. And we were able to get rid of some things, and suddenly the water sort of parted. It really seemed like we had something. And, you know, for the first time, I felt like they were all sort of harmonizing with each other, that they, you know, I was like, oh, I have a lot of stories on this and this. And I was starting to be able to see the themes that I was probably, well, certainly working on subconsciously the last 10 plus years. But this have those sort of bubble to the surface and see these themes about queer identity and masculinity in our culture right now and things of that nature, and this sort of landscape of having stories set all across the country with characters of, you know, young age, adolescence to old age, stories that take place in like rural Oregon in the 30s and present day. It was just it was nice to see this variety of stories have this sort of core element, and that got really exciting. So I was really excited that Buckman wanted to publish it. And that was around a year ago. Yeah, sort of late 2020 that all came together, and we edited the book for the next couple months, but it was pretty quick. I mean, all of it got turned around pretty quick. We went to design of the book pretty quickly because six of the stories had already been published and didn't need nearly as much work as some of the other ones. So I went to work finalizing the remainder, about five stories, and which were the newest in the collection, ones that hadn't been published yet. And yeah, we just published on November 9th this year, right before the Portland Book Fest. Got to be at the Portland Book Festival as an author, doing a pop-up reading. It's just been really wild journey. Well, you know, it took a long time. You know, I mean, it took a really long time. I don't know that I could have done this any faster, needing to work a full-time job, needing to sort of take care of myself all through this process, and then starting late, sort of, you know, trying different careers on for size.
Well, that's a great lesson for people, that they may have to do a couple things at once. They may write slower, or the years that go by are actually influences on the stories that you write as well. So I think there's always this like rush to make art right away, you know, more, you know, and there's this question of, is more may not be better. More may just be rushing something, or it may not be the right time either in life or for the work itself.
Yeah, no, I don't think I could have written this, you know, 15 years ago or even 20 years ago when I was like, I think I want to write a novel. It wouldn't have happened this way. You know, I have a lifetime of experience, and I realized when I was writing that there are no stories in the collection that are strictly sort of coming out stories or love stories. You know, I'm so happy that those types of stories are normalized in our culture right now. There's still not nearly enough of them, but I felt myself writing into this curiosity of all the decades after. You know, you're still constantly coming out in some shape or form, you know, in every social situation or every interaction, having to sort of like negotiate that your whole lifetime. And, you know, there's wounding and trauma that sometimes takes us a lifetime to sort of process and move forward from. So I was really curious, because I didn't have a lot of analogs. I didn't have a lot of like stories that I saw, like what queer life was going to be sort of decades after coming out, or, you know, if one was to survive. I mean, cause I mean, to be honest, like I grew up in the '80s and the early '90s at the height of the AIDS pandemic, the sort of the story that, or epidemic, the stories that I was told, you know, was that I wasn't going to live, you know, and a lot of the elders sort of that would sort of teach us the way didn't survive. Mm. You know, we lost so many. So I've been riding into that space, sort of like the search for queer elders. That's why I've written sort of stories that take place from early periods of queer organizing, sort of historically in the US, like in the 40s here. And I'm really curious how sort of one generation connects to the next, and also how we survive beyond that, like decades. I just didn't have those stories. So that's been the project. I don't know that I knew that was a project until I finished it.
Yeah. And that's that's really important because, the AIDS crisis is real. It happened, but the idea that the whole entire population, that's all they were, you know, or this sort of like people were partying in Studio 54 and that's it, you know, like queer culture is not just AIDS and parties. There are people who fell in love, who worked, who were quirky, who, you know, had jobs, had hobbies, like they're multifaceted. So I think we're missing those stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ubiquitous, like we're everywhere. Okay. I was like, we weren't invented at Stonewall in 1969, yeah. You know, like,
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And so I know you mentioned a little bit about, you know, it's not necessarily every story is a coming out story because we don't really need that, in the sense of just being in literature today, or just being a gay character with a story, I think is the meaningful thing that's needed. You know, the coming out story is needed as well, but it's, if you can see yourself as that person, you know, going on a hike, or, you know, being a comedian, or, you know, having a tea party in the attic, like, yeah. Or, you know, you can right. see yourself sort of in a way that's not just that one stereotypical or three stereotypical type of person, and you realize that, okay, this is one identity, this is one part of me. I am a multifaceted, holistic person.
Yeah, no, and, you know, there's, again, like, there's never enough queer content or stories out there, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I'm so happy how much more is coming online, but it still feels like it's a drop in the bucket compared to everything that's in our culture right now. I'm more attuned to it, like, I, you know, want to watch it and see it and seek that out. But it's, I know, certainly growing up, it was like really, really limited.
We've been noticing that. We were just watching, we're here, that small town drag show. Mm-hmm. You know, not only are there shows like that, but you have, you know, like Love, Simon, Love, Victor, you have just like main on the forefront, whether they're good or not. You know, obviously we need to do better with content, but the idea that gay love stories are mainstream is also just very refreshing. And I know that there was a Kristen Stewart, some people hate her. she had a Hulu Christmas movie. And then I just was reading about another Christmas movie that's going to be on Netflix that has Jennifer Coolidge and some other people as well. And so, just the idea that there's actually media investments around gay stories, where it's not just that, like, a romantic comedy with the one gay neighbor who pops in and just says, like, hey, y'all. You know, like, there's an actual prominent role or a main role, I think is really important. Schitt's Creek, that's another example of that as well. So I think that things are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think, you know, to the extent that there are queer creators making stuff that hasn't been on the bigger small screen before. I mean, Pose is to me like the most recent perfect example, like, especially once they realized they didn't need the story of line of these like the tortured white corporate dude in the first season and sort of got rid of that. And it could just be with this family, this chosen family as characters in that world, and be completely that for the second and third season. I thought this was so powerful and refreshing in so many ways, and you know, just more to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Ryan Murphy, I mean, I like 85% of what he does, but the 85% is worth it.
I am a screenwriter, so I'm not going to be knocking any creators on this podcast.
No, I enjoy Ryan Murphy. There's a couple shows where I'm like, politician. So tell me, for you, I mean, who was your chosen family, you know, back then? And how did you come out? Was it some sort of revelation? Was it?
You know. I think I always knew. I mean, I knew I was queer. I knew I was different. I knew I was attracted, who I was attracted to. It was just a different time. And I just sort of, for my own, wounding, my own, like, sort of processing of it, I didn't come out until after college. You know, I mean, I say this, like, sort of generation to generation can be very different. It may be only a few years apart. I mean, there was a gay straight alliance at my high school, like maybe 2 years after I graduated. So, you know, sort of the line of where things shift, you know, they can be really, the windows can be really short. So I, you know, I came out when I was like 21, 22, right before leaving New York, and then LA was just a fresh start. And yeah, I was going to be gay in LA. No. I mean, that was the other thing, you know, just you kind of start all over again. So, you know, I'm 44 now. I'm sort of like twice as old as I was when I came out. It was a big reset, you know, psychologically, and just orienting yourself to the world again. And just finding out what your scene was, but just like who you wanted to be as a human, let alone like an artist and doing stuff. So, I mean, I can't say I really knew what I was doing too much in my early 20s, just other than trying to be myself and figure out what that was. I mean, I found a job in television right away, so I was kind of just always working, which was fun. I actually worked on the first two seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO as a assistant of the producers, and learned like so much about production. And that was just sort of I was an organized, responsible person. So producer was like this role that I was put into a lot, even in film school. Friends would have me sort of produce their projects. And I mean, great for me, because it was the director track folks that were spending all this money to get equipment and do the projects. And I was just helping them organizing, put it together. It was sort of cheaper way. And maybe slightly less stressful, but, I loved working in television with the sort of the crews and, all the people that I think it comes from doing theater and high school. Like, I loved putting on a show, that sort of that atmosphere. I didn't care if I was on stage or running lights, like that whole process from rehearsal, you know, table read to rehearsal, like all that stuff. I love that. So
did you like having a clipboard and then like a little Britney Spears phone attached to your ear?
I mean, I remember being in film school and being really uncomfortable with the fact that I found I needed to get a cell phone. I mean, cell phones were like pretty sort of rare. I can remember like feeling like such a jerk, like holding this phone up to my head and having a conversation on the street in New York, which just sounds so strange to say today.
Do you remember then who your gay influences were or your gay heroes? I mean, I know that we didn't potentially have the same, you know, like for some people it's Margaret Cho. Some people it's,
you know, who was my in. I mean, it was a lot of music. I mean, it was like artists like Indigo Girls or REM, or just sort of this world that I knew was queer and accessible and sort of more my speed. So I mean, Michael Stipe for sure. I had a lot of work to. I mean, I had a lot of work to do to just sort of like even dig and find those people. I mean, you originally asked about queer elders. I don't know that I had that analog like growing up, certainly. Although my parents had.
Maybe it wasn't a queer elder, but you had a Burt Reynolds or a Tom Selleck.
Well, there was Chad Allen, was very early on. That was. He was like on Our House or something. I'm really dating myself now on your podcast, Michael, but Ryan Felipe, when he was on to Live as like a gay teenager, that was like a really.
I used to like the guys on Boy Meets World. I would be like, oh, why are you thinking about Topanga? What about these boys?
You know, and it's not entirely true that I didn't have queer elders. It's certainly both my parents and my grandmother in particular had. My grandmother came from sort of the dance world and had a lot of folks that she knew that were in the dance world. So she knew like a lot of like Black queer dancers and folks that were sort of in her orbit that I would meet at like my grandmother's parties and stuff like that. Not that that was like being gay was talked about at all, but sort of this model of, oh, there's like a, there's a different orientation. There's a different way to be in the world, in masculine body and that. So that, and my parents had a lesbian couple that they were friends that we used to go over to their house to watch movies.
They were out as a lesbian couple, right? It wasn't like, that's Diane and her roommate Anne.
No, there was, you know, it was not, it was very clear, like, they were a couple, they lived together. They worked with my dad, they were like coworkers. And so, I mean, that was beautiful. And also, you know, I think, especially when you're young and maybe worried that it's not going to be safe to come out, sort of being around queer people can also be like, you know, that they have the superpower to like see right through you. And, and so, you know, it can be a little, you know, maybe not comforting at first, because you, there's sort of that anxiety of, oh, like someone's going to know.
And that's really important what you were talking
about. And that's really damaging.
yeah, absolutely. What I was thinking of is the whole chosen family thing. I mean, that's extremely important. And I think a lot of queer youth, they sort of have to look at their life and ask themselves, like, I could be myself and take that risk and not know if people are going to like me, love me, you know, I might be excommunicated from the church. I might have my mom kick me out, even though they say that they love me. So I think as a society, I think that our queer youth, I hope they do. I think they know that, okay, it's unfortunate if certain people don't want you or want to love you for who you are, but the truth of you being who you are is not only more important, but there will be a whole sea of people will raise you up in that community or that new chosen family that you have.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I would say all through college, I was reading Savage Love, you know, Dan Savage's column, you know, and, you
such
know,
an intellectual.
Every once in a while, there'd be like that, you know, sort of coming out sort of like sort of fretting question about what to do. And I always remember, you know, he's not alone in giving sort of advice is sort of like protect yourself and make sure you have that plan around it. And I don't know how conscious I was doing this, but, you know, I really didn't come out until I had moved to LA, had my own apartment and had a job. So I knew there was like sort of, if the worst thing happened that like nobody talked to me or like I was cut off, I didn't, I'd be okay. And, you know, I was probably going to be okay before that. But the fact that for me, just having that little bit of security was super, super helpful.
And I know that you, we're talking a lot about what we pick up, but also there's gargoyles and dandelions. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's a screenplay I wrote. It's an original pilot episode of what I would imagine is, you know, what I would envision as a limited series. I call it a queer noir because it's a murder mystery set in Hollywood in the late 1940s, sort of at the height of studios like MGM, you know, turning out musicals, and also this period of history where World War II had just ended and there were so many gay and lesbian queer people in the armed services that sort of found each other in the armed services. And after the war did not want to, you know, go to their small hometowns anymore. I mean, once they realized that there were other people like them, that's, you know, sort of that flocking to big cities, and Los Angeles more than any city on the West Coast, you know, just had such an influx of veterans, I think actually more than any city in the country. And so it's just this period of time where Los Angeles is going through such an amazing explosion, population wise, and just this mix of sort of bohemian and folks that came from the theater world in New York that, you know, were working in Hollywood, and, you know, sort of this, so there's sort of this like more libertarian, or libertine, I should say, not libertarian. That's sort of a loaded word now, but sort of libertine, you know, European attitudes about sex. And it was just this perfect combination. I mean, there were a lot of, you asked me about the script, but sort of this is like the sort of the world that it's set in, you know, with lots of gay clubs and lesbian bars and, you know, sort of underground stuff that was happening all over the city, especially downtown around Pershing Square. And I'm so fascinated with that period of history. And then by 1950, 51, you have you start to see this organizing happening, where people are organizing around, you know, even like housing rights and sort of interracial dating and a lot of different issues that were bubbling up throughout the country, but especially in Los Angeles, the labor rights movement, civil rights movement, all these things. And sort of this idea of queer organizing starts to blossom there. And I know that was happening in other cities too, but the Mattachine Society, you know, sort of first took off in LA in the early 50s, and One Magazine a little bit later in the 50s, you know, despite it being illegal to ship that stuff around the country, they had to do all sorts of weird things to sort of get away with what they were doing at the time. But I find that period of history, and I like sort of connecting that back to my history and kind of thinking who my elders were sort of growing up at the, you know, kind of dealing with the height of the AIDS crisis, or, and their elders sort of, if we want to call it like sort of Stonewall era, and then those before, and on and on. So that's the origin of this pilot script. It's got like this really big cast. It's really big budget. Like, you know, that's probably a reason it hasn't been sold yet, but it's a passion project that started as a novel, and I realized that it was coming through as a TV series and decided to write it that way instead. And this pilot was what got the fellowship and drama here in 2019. I took it to the Austin Film Festival. It sort of placed as a what's called a second rounder in the Austin Film Festival, which is not even like semi-finalist level, but it's a great festival for writers, a great writers conference, because they sort of give this extra status to the top 20% of all the scripts that they get in the festival. They get like maybe 14,000-15,000 scripts. And then, you know, they have lots of programming for folks that are sort of make that top 20%. It's not just like, oh, you didn't win the award, like, we don't care about you. That's kind of this really cool, warm festival. So
that's good. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said, yeah, it hasn't been made yet.
I mean, I went to that festival like 3 months before lockdown. So, or 3-4 months before lockdown. So it's been, we've all been on a journey.
Well, a lot of times with things we see, like whether it's TV or movies, we end up learning like, wow, this has been a development for 10 years, or this is an idea that someone had 15 years ago, and then, you know,
it's waiting for the right time. I mean, and honestly, like when I wrote it, when I first won that award, like Pose hadn't come out yet, or Pose was just about to come out, you know, and now that's sort of like a comp that I would use to talk about the show. You know, the sort of, you have the period of LA of like the Perry Mason reboot on HBO. That's really just sort of like moody, cool, very like serious, not super genre, like noirish show mixed with, yeah, like all queer characters the way you would have in a Pose. And the theatricality, because it's said with people that sort of work at it's a made up name in the show, but sort of an MGM style studio that was making these, you know, humongous big budget musicals. And all, you know, a lot of the key behind the scenes talent were all gay. It's, you know, it's just, it was the mass market entertainment of its time.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've always been there, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll still continue to be here. And it sounds odd, but Andy and I sometimes look at our nephews, not that we're like, oh, I wish one of them would be gay, but we're kind of like, maybe one of our nephews is gay, you know? And that's right. I mean, that is the beauty of diversity, is you have people of all different types. So I like to think America's moving forward, but I also see America moving backwards. So I'm proud of people like you who push the envelope or present truth as it is, because if we don't do that, especially in this time, we're not going to capture the full historical effect of where things are at or where things are moving.
I mean, no, thank you for saying that. I can't emphasize enough sort of this generation of storytellers that were decimated by AIDS as well. And that just like, I feel like we're only now starting to catch up with all the stories that would have been told in some way that we you know, without that. And there's, you know, so many beautiful stories to come. But generationally, I mean, things are a lot different. I have a really good batting record in that 3 of my 4 nieces are queer, so.
Putting something in their water.
Yeah. I'm very proud of that. You know, and it's not that the culture is more gay or like, yeah, like, you know, putting something in the water. Yeah. Just people are much more comfortable in their own skin and talking about it, and the sort of, you know, my sister's generation, our generation of like sort of Gen X parents are just so much more skilled.
And that's something that's really great too, because even the people years ago who did end up coming out, you know, they maybe did so in their 60s or lived a life that they didn't want to live. There was so much strife. So the idea that today, of course, it's still challenging, you know, especially for transgender, non-binary folks. But the idea that you can actually live your truth earlier on and you can build a life around you, I think is wonderful, because if you develop in a way that society wants you to, or your parents want you to, you're sort of suppressing yourself over the course of the time in your life when you need to be developing. And so that's really, it's horribly sad, but I like to think, even just talking to younger kids, I call myself a kid, like younger kids, you know, they have these conversations about, they'll be like, oh, that's John's boyfriend, or that's like, and completely casual. And I think about like junior high or high school, and I would have never heard that. It would have never been so casually said. It would have never been like, oh, he's showing up, there's his boyfriend.
Yeah. Even our sort of apartment manager here when we first moved to Portland, you know, despite us very explicitly telling, sort of still referred to us as roommates, or you know, the sort of like this old way of thinking, the sort of pre-programmed, you know. I also want to see like good intention, a lot of folks like censoring themselves or like not knowing what to say, certainly early on, but you know, at a certain point you sort of you can only extend so much grace if folks aren't willing to do the work or do the homework,
yeah,
or sort of think about what it might be like on the other.
What you just mentioned is really important too, is that there are people who are anti, you know, homophobic, transphobic, whatever. They will never embrace people of differences. But then there are people who they're still learning. And so if we immediately put them in the list of hateful, we don't recognize those people So there's a, you know, there's a difference between someone who is purposefully calling someone their dead name and ignoring who someone is, and then someone who is reading about transgender folks, listening to them, but is still not used to getting pronouns right. But when they do get them wrong, they correct themselves. So we have to sort of be patient with a culture of learning and a cultural shift, and not put all those people into the, you know, the hateful category. But you're also, you also can't be too patient, because if someone's not even trying, you know, then they're not even trying. So I think sometimes the people who are progressive, I mean, and I'm talking about myself, because I'm pretty progressive, you know, we have to be more forgiving. We can't do these purity tests of every single word and every single pronoun has to be correct, or this person is hateful. Maybe they are, but maybe they're actually not. Maybe they're just someone on the path to learning.
No, I mean, that's a good point. You know, it's, I mean, when I came out, like, individually to both my parents, they were like split up at the time. So it was like two separate conversations. But, you know, I had kind of pointed, like, this was not, like, my journey of like coming out was done. Like, it was their work to now process what it meant to have a gay son, or, you know, what it meant, like, how they were going to show up, how they were going to act. It had really, you know, it had left my body, like, in terms of something that I was going to be just hating myself or traumatized anymore by. And, you know, I think it's like recognizing who needs to do the work, who needs to, you know, in our culture right now, it's cis white dudes that need to do.
Yeah, that's
a majority.
That's
of the
a
work.
Really good. That's a really good point. You know, it's not the role of, you know, black women to teach white males about racism. They have to go and do that work themselves.
And also, I say that like gay, queer, you know, living with a disability and other stuff going on, but I walk around in a cis white dude body. I have a mustache, like, you know, like,
sure do.
I'm pretty dude. I know it doesn't pop on the podcast, really.
It's a good mustache.
Thank you. But, you know, I joke, but like, it's my work, you know, it's, for me, like, a process of talking about that within my sphere, sort of writing stories into that and sort of modeling what that experience, you know, there's a different way to be in a masculine body and relate to your own gay identity, your queer identity, and be in community with other people and not seek to do harm. So just to sort of model that.
Yeah,
you know, in some of these stories, and
the reality is that it's different for every queer person, their family, how they feel, who they are, but there is straight acting or straight passing, and that might be somewhat of a privilege, because if that's not who you are, which is fine, you're just as beautiful, you have to constantly explain to people. People ask you, are you a woman? Are you a man? Why are you feminine? Why are you doing this? Why are you dressing like that? So it's a constant over and over and over again. And so you're absolutely right in the sense of there's only so much educating you can do. It's the other person who has to make that decision if they're going to want to grow and become culturally sensitive and respectful. And I think that's really difficult. I think knowing when it's not your responsibility and it's theirs, knowing when you can let go of that, is difficult, because the other way is extremely exhausting. If all you're doing is either apologizing for who you are or explaining for who you are or educating who you are.
No, absolutely. No, extremely exhausting. You know, that's what it's like. It's why we make art and protest and like do stuff. Like, we have to be in our bodies and do our own thing, it's not to say that we're not worrying about them per se, but it's a we, like we're all part of the, like there's really, I mean, unless you're able to carve out, you know, an island to yourself with completely chosen family, you know, we're all part of this culture together. Like we're sort of all gonna, you know, live or die together.
It's really, well, what do you say to your nieces who identify as queer about the history of being queer, or about what has happened and where we're at? You know, like I don't think that youth is gonna forget or not become educated, but I also think that I have somewhat of a concern or worry that we will reach a time where people maybe either will take that symbol for granted or not go back and look at those histories. And so,
I don't see that tension necessarily resolving itself in my lifetime. But I would flip the script a little bit on your question, because, you know, I feel like my nieces have so much to teach me about what it means to be themselves at that age. I mean, there was like maybe one out person in my high school when I was going there, you know, and he was bullied, and it was just a super isolating, awful thing. And I know my nieces, you know, all had different experiences with high school. Not to say that like anybody's high school doesn't have its sort of traumas, but just they're on the other side of that, and you know, had so many more examples in their sphere of friends. Like it's far beyond like me to sort of me and John being like the gay uncles and in their lives and present, and like I know all that has value. I'm not trying to minimize that, but I think there's just so many peers and others that they've been able to access, and resources, honestly, and the internet.
Well, and when you see someone, when you see someone being themselves and embracing who they are, you know, whether it's a queer child who has leaned into it, embraced it, or whether it's someone who's trans, who's transitioning, and you can feel their joy and that they are living their truth and their sincerity and their authenticity. And so, I mean, that alone should tell people, like, you know, wake up. It's not worth being someone else. So I am excited that the youth of the age of your, you know, your nieces are at this place where they feel like it's more important and more valuable to be myself. And I don't care what anybody else thinks. Sure, there's going to be people who are going to either bully you or tell you that you're wrong, but it's sort of like self-importance and truth are starting to win over the other, which is very, I don't know, exciting. You have to be cautiously optimistic, of course, because there is still gay bashing, hate crimes, and, you know, we just had Transgender Remembrance Week, so not to make light of any of that, but the idea that someone can just be themselves as a child, I mean, it seems so commonplace, and yet it's been such a struggle for society.
Yeah, I mean, I love seeing depictions of, I'm reading this script right now, that it involves like this non-binary child and his gay dad, and I'm reading scripts for this lab that I've been a part of, and I'm just immediately in love that this like script exists in the world, and the characters are just like so funny and irreverent and beautiful, and all that to say, there's also a ton of work to do. So like, I mean, it's just, it's a reminder to me that I have found some chosen family. I have found elders. Like, ideally I am acting that role to my nieces and, you know, others through my writing. But we, as queer people, at least, like, we have to find that, that every generation has to find their sort of people to have that experience, because they don't necessarily have that experience at all in their biological family. I mean, some of us are lucky to have, you know, other queer people in our family, but I didn't growing up, you know, like, I didn't have a model for that. Anybody that, any of my friends, any of my, that I know of at the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me how you met John.
John and I are a gay.com success story. I think you all know the gays got on to online dating a lot earlier than the straights did. So, yeah, we met, sort of had this email correspondence. This is back in 2002. So we've been together a while. And yeah, we went on a first date sort of this time of year, fall, 2002, and hit it off. And yeah, it's been a, I mean, it's been a journey. We've moved cross country twice. We've been through a lot together. We've changed, both changed careers, and for him going to grad school and me deciding to write and not do production anymore. It's just been a journey. So fortunate to have someone you can grow and change with, because relationships take work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're all domesticated. Doing laundry and house projects and things like that. So I have five questions for you. These are the five questions that I've been asking podcast guests this season. So the first one is, what is a quote or a mantra that you live by?
That I live by. I'm going to read you one that I have. It's been on my board for like the last 2 years, because it's just been really striking me this last 2 years. So it's by Adi Ashanti, from their book, The End of Your World. And it's, this isn't a journey about becoming something. It is about unbecoming who we are not. Hmm. And I just, yeah, I love that.
Not to be confused with Dante and Ja Rule.
No.
No, that's a good one. That makes you think. And I like the ones that make you think. What is your favorite childhood memory?
Oh, gosh. My favorite memories, probably they have to do with water or road trips. So it's either like related to pools, like going to the beach, going to like
SoCal boy.
Yeah, Lake Mead. When we were kids, our friends had a boat, or we would like rent a houseboat and like spend the night, you know, on the lake before the lake was as low, you know, sadly low as it is now. And road trip. I mean, to this day, John and I love road trips. That's why we get along so well. I mean, those moves cross country were drives. Mm-hmm. So the, yeah, I love that journeying. So does that answer your question? Those are probably the happiest.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you road trip, is it podcasts or music or both? Does one of you like to sing?
Usually both. Yeah. It's like definitely like soundtrack to your life sort of music part. But then yeah, no, we love listening to podcasts or occasional audiobook. We read a lot of different stuff, so there's not always like a good fit for the audiobook necessarily, but a podcast for sure.
What about singing?
That's all right. No, we'll knock it. I will sing. I tend to sing more than in the car, more than John does. But.
Yeah. What's a failure or mistake that you made that actually turned out to be for the best?
That turned out for the best. And I think I was talking about just in terms of sort of leaving the production world behind. I mean, I was six, seven years into sort of building up credits and sort of this building myself up as someone who could be sort of at a producer level, at a sort of higher production level. And really, I made a really good decision to abandon all that. I mean, that was partially embedded in the choice of Portland, where we knew, although there is, you know, film and TV production here and advertising and stuff like that, it felt much smaller and certainly not the most important thing the way it is in Los Angeles, where the biggest, you know, sort of industry the way it was. So we would just sort of like not be tempted to necessarily go just get one of these jobs and be working nonstop and not be able to like tend to ourselves. It just was not sort of regulating.
Well, and you can still become a producer or be a producer on your own projects, which I think is actually a better, more creative, more powerful thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would love that to the extent a showrunner, like the sort of the particular sort of like Shonda Rhimes, Ryan Murphy, like that sort of job, that sort would kill me. I think it's just, I'm far too much of an anxious, like that would just, it would not be good for my nervous system. Let's just put it that way. That would not be healthy for me.
Yeah.
But to be the creator, like sort of sell a script and sort of be involved, but not so involved that I had, you know, I couldn't sleep or something. I don't, you know, that takes a unique personality and type, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to create your own name like Shondaland.
Like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some good combos with Brewster, but yeah, I'm not writing that over and over on a notebook.
The next question is, what issue or issues keep you up at night?
Oh gosh, like the existential ones.
Sure. Or not, you know, like
white supremacy, guns, and toxic masculinity and in all of those combinations.
Yeah, you add those with climate change and it's just like, where are we going? Thanks, Stacey.
They're bad enough on their own, so yeah. You asked a question.
I know I did ask the question. I prompted it. Those are all good issues. Not good that you're kept up at night thinking about them, but those are all really important issues. And then a fun one, who is your favorite pop star or your favorite band?
Oh, I have to pick one. Well,
give me a few.
I mentioned them earlier. Like, I think like if I need sort of a uplift, and just like kind of my go-to feel good, like Indigo Girls or REM, like it's always going to like sort of put me there in sort of my happy spot.
Yeah, but what if you're listening to REM, End of the World?
That's okay. It's fun. It's a fun song. It's fun to sing.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be with a crowd of people. And, yeah, Leonard Bernstein, you know. It's just,
yeah.
It's a good feeling.
Yeah, I agree. So the last part of this is I really want folks to know how they can buy your book, What We Pick Up.
Yeah.
And then I also would like for you to give some sort of shout out to either business, a community member, your writing group, anybody who you feel is deserving of a shout out. Yeah.
Oh, so many shout outs. Well, first of all my information, sort of like my story and where to get the book is all on my website, which is just stacybrewster.com. Stacy spelled S-T-A-C-Y. Brewster, like punky, B-R-E-W-S-T-E-R. yeah, got information on the book, other stuff that I've got going on. I do some creative coaching, have a business called Lodge Creative Northwest that I started several years ago when actually sort of disability in my arms, chronic pain and neuropathy that popped up. I wasn't sure how much I was going to be able to write. And I sort of created this business as sort of an avenue to help folks with their writing, or get a project out the door if they were looking just for setting up a process around their creative practice, whether it's permission or getting a, you know, particular, getting a plan together to sort of get a project out the door. I love doing that type of stuff. Do that with my writing group. Well, a lot of shout outs. I mean, I wouldn't be here with this book out if it weren't for Write Around Portland. That's a nonprofit here. I think they just celebrated 20 years last year. Their mission, I don't know if you know them very well, but they do free 10-week writing workshops for those who would not otherwise have access to writing in community with other people because of any sort of barrier in their life, whether that's income, disability, isolation. And so I trained as a volunteer workshop facilitator for them back in 2008. Had been volunteering with them like the year before, almost like as soon as I landed in Portland, got sort of hooked up with them. And that organization was just fantastic. I mean, their motto is respect writing community, and just being around those tables, being fortunate enough to being around those tables, at senior living centers and, you know, with gay seniors and, you know, just like this wide range of folks, burn trauma survivors, out at, Legacy Emmanuel, just, I love the work that they do in community. I think it's so important. They build community. These writers go on to, you know, kind of set up their own writing groups, and sort of that first sense of them having that identity as a writer or creative person, that's such a barrier for a lot of folks. And their mission, it's been a little different, obviously, in pandemic times, and they've been doing workshops virtually, but there's always, they publish a book with each season of writers. So every writer has at least one piece in this book, and they have a public reading for it. And I remember going to one of those my first time, my first few months in Portland, at this like church downtown. I was just like, everybody in the pew like that I was in went up to read, and I was like, I want to do that. Like, I want, like, this is amazing. That's when I decided to train as a facilitator and work with them. So that's always my go-to. But I was just at the Portland Book Festival, and like one sort of workhorse here in the publishing world here in Portland. And there's like 30, 40 indie publishers just here in Portland, just like cranking out like just amazing work. Like mine, Buckman Publishing. And Laura Stanfill, who runs Forest Avenue Press here, she's just such an amazing, she's an, you know, writer in her own right. She has her first novel coming out next year. And she's someone who demystifies the process for everyone else. Like my whole like writing career was like, oh, let me read stories over at PSU, just like see what's being, you know, submitted for a journal. Like it was always like a process of like, let me demystify what it's like to even get something like this published. Cause I didn't get an MFA. I didn't sort of train in that. And Laura's like this powerhouse of like a indie publisher here in the space. And she's, you know, won a ton of stuff, but she has a Substack and is always sort of like explaining the process to people. I wish I had read her posts. Like her last post was about book contracts. And I was like, oh, I probably should have read this or talked to Laura before I signed my book contract. Not that, you know, there was anything wrong, but it was like so, so helpful to sort of explain.
Well, now you have a neighbor who's a business and IP attorney as well.
Yes. Yes. No, no, we will definitely have a conversation before there's some, the next contract.
She sounds like a great person. And I think that, you know, writing is a gift, education is a gift, access is a gift. And when I say gift, I mean, deserving, people should already have it, but there are people who have to give it to those who maybe don't already have those things. So the people who do that, who consciously make sure that people have what they need and what they deserve, I have a very high regard in life for, you know, and whatever that may be, because those are so important. I mean, to have either a child or Stacy as an adult, you know, to have someone either give you the opportunity or put you on a stage or read what you've written, those are essential for not just society from a cultural perspective, because we would never hear those words, right, or see that art. But for that one individual, you're giving them an opportunity to be heard and potentially to have a career. So it takes a special person to do that. And I'm going to give you those opportunities.
Sort of demystify it, but build community while you're doing it. I mean, the Portland writing community is like so incredibly like warm and tender and supportive. And like, I mean, you can't, you know, throw stick in this town without hitting a writer pretty much. But it's amazing just sort of the depth of talent here. And the I've always benefited from having a writing group, just to sort of peers to talk shop with and talk about each other's stories, or just if we have nothing else to do, like bring a couple prompts and write for 15 minutes together and share that out loud, is a huge part of like every week that we meet my writing group. And we've been going like over 10 years. So shout out to them.
What's your writing group called?
We are the Full Frontal Writing Collective. About just sort of being bare as possible on the page, sort of letting it all out. I can't remember who named it that, but it stuck. We always thought we'd come up with something different, but it just stuck. So
I really appreciate you not only being on my podcast, but being my friend and my neighbor. And I look forward to seeing, you know, the scope of your career, writing and producing. And yeah, it's one day at a time, but.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's been great to have you guys next door, or I guess technically across the street, but yeah. I love like the work you're doing, Michael, and like demystifying it for others. You know what I mean? Like making it make sense to others through your conversations. Like, I think that's really great.
Well, thank you. Don't make me cry at the end of this podcast episode.
No, we don't want to do that.
Say hi to your lovely husband for me and your
likewise. Dog.
And we'll see you soon. Thank you for doing this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
We want to thank Stacy Brewster for being on this episode of the show. If you'd like to learn more about Stacy or order the book, What We Pick Up, visit stacybrewster.com. Be sure not to miss any of our upcoming guests by subscribing to the podcast on your favorite streaming service. You can also visit alloftheyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, custom gear, and if you happen to know anybody that you think would be a great fit for the podcast, click our contact page and let us know.